What is up, everybody? I am back with another episode of Most Wanted. This week's piece of shit is Robert William Fisher. I'm going to start by giving you his height, weight, date of birth, place of birth, all those good things. So let's jump right in. So Robert was born on April 13th of 1961. His height is 6 foot even. He is expected to weigh 190 pounds. Now, remember, this was last taken at least in 2001, being that that was when he was last seen. So we don't know his exact weight to this day. He could be much smaller or much heavier. His place of birth was in Brooklyn, New York, although he did move to Arizona with his family. He's currently looking at 3 first-degree murder felony charges, 1 first-degree arson, and an unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. He has not been convicted of any of these crimes. In Robert's early life, he didn't have the worst life, but he also had the dream life. His parents divorced not so early, but when he was 15. Although he was known for being outdoorsy, that seemed to be his getaway, I guess. Which is great, you know, I personally feel like more kids should spend time outside. And I think that was a great thing for him to be doing, that he was learning to survive in the wild. Now, we'll touch back on that later, that he was basically preparing himself for the future at that point without even realizing it. So he was one of 3 children in his house. He was the only boy. He had 2 sisters. And his parents moved him from Brooklyn, New York to Arizona. Now, that in itself is a huge change. I personally went through a huge, you know, cultural change myself as a kid. So I get where that has some effects that are long-lasting and I would be comfortable saying permanent changes to your personality. So I feel like that might have something to do with who he ended up becoming, although it's no excuse. So his parents' divorce was very nasty. I feel like a divorce for a kid in itself is a very hard thing. No child wants to hear from their parents, "Hey, we are getting a divorce." No kid wants to hear that their parents are no longer going to be under the same roof. I don't care how old you are, you're going to hold some type of guilt or resentment to one or the other parent. That may have had something to do with, you know, his end result of his person, but who's to know? So, aside from his overall, you know, pretty okay life, he ended up going to be a soldier in the Navy. He was a lot of, actually, really great things in his lifetime. He worked at the Mayo Clinic as a surgical catheter technician, a respiratory therapist. He worked at the Mayo Clinic as a surgical catheter technician and a respiratory therapist, and he was also a fireman. So, those 3 things, I, at first glance, would be like, oh, yeah, seems like a great guy, you know, really cares about others. Well, I guess, you know, the term "don't judge a book by a cover" is as truthful as it gets in this situation. you know, anybody who hears general stuff about this guy right now is thinking, oh, wow, you know, he really cared about people. You know, he was a soldier, he worked in the hospital, and he was a fireman. What a great guy, right? No, he's a piece of shit. So when Robert got out of the Navy, he went on to marry his wife, Mary Cooper, in 1987. From what her family says about the couple is that, you know, they are the dream couple. They love Robert. They think, you know, that Robert's the perfect man for their daughter. And they really had a image of being this amazing couple. He put on this face of being just so perfect and the best husband and father. And I guess he should have been an actor too, because he was really good at fooling people. The only people he didn't have fooled were his neighbors. So his neighbors would report hearing the couple fight quite often, so loud that they could hear and make out what the fights were about in their own homes next door. But they say that they rarely would hear his voice in the arguments. They would really only hear her voice. So, all right, so what's confusing me in that situation is she was said to be a very submissive wife in the relationship. She was very low-spoken, and he was very, very controlling. So, with him being so controlling and her being so submissive, I find it odd that the neighbors would only hear her sides of the argument. So, when they would be fighting, they would typically be fighting about sex and money. You know, most couples, that is what they are fighting about, typically. So, it's not like they were having these weird arguments either. They were having, you know, regular couple arguments. And I'm still having a hard time understanding, you know, again, why he was very quiet during these arguments, being that he was known for being so rude. He was known to be a cruel and really controlling person towards his family. Like, his wife, Mary, had once spoken up to him, and he made it very impossible for her. She wasn't allowed to have any say against or above him. He once got so mad at her, he turned a water hose on her for speaking up to him. She wasn't even allowed to paint the walls any other color but white. White. That is the most boring color. Why, though? Why could she only paint the walls white? She wasn't even allowed to cover these walls with a quilt or something. He was so controlling. It had to be his way all the time. I don't understand it. So she quickly got, you know, real sick of this. She had taken a job, and she told her friends that it was going to be a security fund. Now, not like, oh, in case we don't make bills this week. No, by security fund, she meant for her and the kids to get out. She realized this guy isn't what her and her kids need. So, hopefully she was using this money eventually to leave him. She doesn't specify to anybody, you know, yes, it's definitely to leave Robert, or if it's definitely to put it on bills. I don't know, but if she's making a security fund, she got all this going on at home, that tells me that she's trying to get out. She's saving up, so that way it's going to be a smooth get-out escape type thing for her and these kids, being that he is so controlling of them. He was embarrassed of his son, Bobby. He was Robert William Fisher Jr. He was just went by Bobby. He was embarrassed by him because Bobby didn't like to go outside and hunt and fish and go camping. He didn't like the outdoorsy things. So this man was so embarrassed by his child, he put him in a class for being outdoors. Like, what? You're so embarrassed to your child, you will literally pay to make him different? Make him more like you? I'm sorry, but if somebody doesn't like something, you can't make them like something, and you can't be embarrassed by it. You know, having a kid, you can't just assume they're going to be just like you, like all the same things you do. Because if that was the truth, we would all be essentially the same. Nobody would be different if we grew up and were just like our mom, or just like our dad, and they were just like their moms, and just like their dads. It's not how it works. We like different things. Each person is a different human being. So that really upsets me, that he was genuinely upset and embarrassed and bothered by his son not being like him. What kind of human just is embarrassed by their kid? What? Don't be a father if you're going to be embarrassed by your children, or a mother for that instance. You know, don't go having children if you're going to assume they're going to grow up and be just like you. Because they're not. They're not. They might have, you know, some of your same tendencies, a few of your likes, but they're not going to be just like you. All right, rant over. So, Robert, like I said, he was real outdoors type person, and that started from a very young age. So, on one occasion, at least, he was caught, I'm sorry, not caught. He was out, you know, I'm going to assume hunting, being that he had a gun in this particular experience. He was out hunting, we'll say, and he snuck up on this family having a nice picnic and shot his gun and emptied it into the air to scare them. Now, that tells me that he likes knowing he has the power to scare people for their lives. I don't know. I think that in itself is kind of creepy. So, with all this being said, you know, he clearly likes having power over people in general. Not, like, just his family or just strangers. No, he clearly likes having power over everybody. That's kind of creepy. You know, that is, sounds like some Hitler-type shit, if you ask me. If you like being so powerful and so scary over others that you're willing to scare them for their lives, I don't know, something's kind of off there, if you ask me. I would be comfortable saying it's the same thing that's wrong in Hitler's mind. Well, was wrong in Hitler's head. Just killing random people because they didn't have the same beliefs. So, let's move on to 1998. The couple was a part of the Scottsdale Baptist Church, and Robert was part of the men's ministry, and Mary, I'm gonna assume, was a big part in the church, being that she stuck with it. She was very active in the church from day one to her very last day. She was a huge part of the church. Now, they started going to couples therapy They went to marital counseling in 1998, and
Robert confided in a coworker that he had hired a prostitute that he found in a massage parlor in December of 2000. The couple began marriage counseling in 1998. And I'm going to assume this is for, you know, all the fighting and everything at home. I would definitely agree they needed it. They did this with the pastor of their church. Now, in 2000, he had confided in a coworker that he had hired a prostitute that he found in a massage parlor in, you know, December. And this caused him to get a UTI that left him ill for several days. Now, if you ever had a UTI, you know that shit hurts. And he was worried that Mary would find out where this came from. Now, you would think it'd be just easier to, I don't know, not have sex with people in massage parlors. I don't know. To me, that sounds like a really great idea. I personally would not have sex with anyone in a massage parlor. You know, it's not clean, I imagine. It's not the cleanest place to have sex with just some random person. Like, that's a whole nother thing. Like, so you're just going around having sex with random people. I understand that's, like, a thing. There's people out there who like prostitutes, like one-night stands. To each his own. You know, I'm not going to shame anybody for their preferences. But, dude, you got a whole wife and kids at home. What? So you out here going to a massage parlor, getting laid, going home, and now you gotta lie to your wife, not only about what you were doing, but for several days about why you can't have sex with your wife, and tell her, you know, whatever crazy excuse he made up for this UTI, and he was afraid his wife would find out. So he ends up confiding in the pastor now, and tells his pastor, hey, you know, I had kind of met this prostitute, and I had sex with her, and I got a UTI from it. And the pastor's like, don't confide in me about this. You need to confide in your wife. And so he was like, you need to confide in your wife about this. And Robert just, he didn't see that to be an option. He was just like, hard no. I'm not confiding in my wife about the one thing I'm coming to you to talk about. No. So, now we're in 2001. And Mary starts getting more and more upset. She's getting sick and tired of Robert and all of this bullshit he's putting her through. You know, all this controlling manner stuff. And, you know, I imagine she hated the fact that he was embarrassed by her son. I would leave right there. If you're embarrassed by my kid, we're done. Done. Big time done. But, so, Mary spoke to her friends and family, like, about filing for divorce just before her end day. She just started, you know, talking about it more and more. She would bring it up in arguments and say, you know, that she wanted to divorce him. And that was kind of really hard for him to hear, being that he got really hit hard with his parents' divorce. And he didn't want to experience that pain again for himself. And he claims to have not wanted to let his kids go through that pain either. So he goes to a friend and is like, and I quote, I could not live without this family. Now, I could not live without this family, to me, is, no, people use that loosely. It could be just an exaggeration, but with this guy's extreme mindsets, it's clearly not that, you know, that he cannot live without his family. To his friends, so his friends clearly, you know, felt that he was, you know, an extreme person. So they took it as he was suicidal. But the friend didn't, like, verbalize that, you know. I'm going to assume that the friend didn't put these dots together until after the crimes. But that was definitely, you know, a statement to talk about. Being that he made that clear, he verbalized it, that he could not live without his family. That seems a little odd. You know, he's so controlling and he's embarrassed by his kid. There's a lot wrong here. So she starts telling her friends that she wants a divorce from Robert. You know, he's just so controlling and he's everything, you know? He's mean, he's an anal asshole, really. But he wasn't taking divorce as an option. And he was very clearly nervous to end up like his parents as a divorced couple.
So being that he was so afraid of being divorced, he was willing to go to any length to not do exactly that. There was nothing he wasn't willing to do. He would rather be on the run and be on America's Most Wanted than simply be divorced and make his children experience having divorced parents. That's where the fear lied for him. He was afraid that his children would feel the same as he did growing up with his parents' nasty divorce. He didn't want his daughter Brittany and Bobby to, you know, experience that pain he went through. So on the night of April 9th of 2001, neighbors were yet again hearing the couple fighting. It was, you know, as it's been, a pretty nasty fight. And the next day at 8:42 a.m., the Fisher House in the 2000 block of North 74th Street, there was an explosion that it rattled houses within a half a mile radius. Could you imagine that? Being woken up to your house's frame being shaken by an explosion of your neighbor. That's scary. You know, I'd be really scared. So 911 calls start flooding in. You can actually look up the 911 calls. There's a lot of documentaries on YouTube that you can actually go in, listen to these people reporting the explosion. Some of them freaking out. Mostly the women were freaking out, saying there's people in this house. And nobody, of course, is able to say yes or no who it is. They didn't know at this point, you know, who's still in this house with the explosion. All they know is, yes, there's definitely someone in this home, and it is up in flames. It took no time at all for this house to burn absolutely to the ground. It was absolutely arson. The idea of it just being an inconvenient fire or explosion never crossed anyone's minds. From square one, they knew 100%, you know, this was, in fact, foul play. As this was being reported, there was news helicopters already flying over this house, taking footage. And as one of the firefighters came in, this part actually bothers me a lot. One firefighter, when he first got on scene, he says to someone that is looking at the explosion, you know, standing by, that he knew before he even walked in that house that there was definitely people in there and they were undoubtedly dead at that point. And the reason he said this, he said, is that there was a smell of
burning flesh so strong that he'll never forget it. And that's scary. That's sad. It's really sad. Nobody at this point knew who was still in the home. A lot of people, of course, knew that this was a home to two children. Young children, you know, a 10-year-old as the youngest. Could you imagine that? I wouldn't wish that on anybody, to have to let their child burn. What the hell, man? Who does this? But anyways, before I get myself too hyped up about just that statement alone. So when they got the fire out, they, of course, immediately, there's investigators on scene. They're checking everything out. And they found it odd that, again, this is first glance, investigators walking in as soon as fires are out. They found it odd that the three people in the home, which would be Mary, Brittany, Bobby, the two children and the wife, and they found it very odd that none of them were in a position that seemed as though they were trying to escape. They were all lying comfortably in their beds, it seemed to look like, at least. Of course, they're not comfortable. They were all laying what looks to be like they just were still sleeping. And I'm not, you know, a forensic analyst. I don't know what people look like when their house just exploded and they're dead. I don't know what they would typically look like. I don't know what position they would typically be in. But the fact that they were laying down comfortably is what immediately got the investigators' attentions. From what they said, it would be that they would typically, from an explosion of that power, they may be, you know, a step off the bed or trying to get out of bed, something to that effect. But they would not be lying comfortably. Now, being that they were lying comfortably is what made them look a little further. One team goes down to look at the furnace while the other team, they're investigating these bodies. And now, when an explosion happens in a house or anything, people think, oh, the bodies, they're going to be unidentifiable. They're going to be burnt to a crisp. You're not going to be able to tell anything about the body after the explosion, after they've been burned to this extent. But that is not the case. Now, they were not fighting their way through these fires. The explosions did not happen in any of their rooms. So, they were intact. Their bodies were intact. They, of course, were burnt pretty badly, but their bodies were not in pieces. They were just burnt. So, they were able to analyze these bodies, their skin, bones, whatnot. They notice there is, this is hard to even talk about. There is a slit on each one of their necks from ear to ear. This man slit each one of their throats from ear to ear. And it's speculated that he would have gone and did this to the children first, being that they wouldn't put up as much as a fight, if they would put up a fight, to him, and then he would move on to Mary. And being that he could kill them quickly and quietly, and much easier, it would not alarm anyone else, of course. Now, if he would have started with Mary, she probably would have put up a fight, been loud, obnoxious, and probably woken up the children, and this would have put a dent in his plan. So he goes to her after he kills the children, slits her throat. That is her initial cause of death. Of course, speculated. That would be her initial cause of death. And then he goes back and is like, I'm still mad at you. There's still not going to be a divorce. I'd rather kill you and the children than let you get what you want and that be a divorce. So he shoots her in the head as like, bitch, fuck you. Now that he has killed his whole family, he went and he cuts the line, the gas line, to the furnace. This is going to, you know, slowly spread the gases throughout the house. And he strategically places a candle to where it would give him more than enough time to escape from the house before it would blow. And by blowing up the house, he assumed it would not only cover up his murders, but also make authorities assume that he died in the fire. I guess he thought, oh, they're gonna basically turn to ashes. You know, he didn't realize how, I guess, it all works. Because that's not what happened. They knew, alright, this guy ain't here, and he's not the smartest cookie. He took the family dog, he took Mary's car, and knew, alright, I have this much time, roughly, and I need to get out of here. And he took Mary's 4Runner. He goes to the local bank and withdraws the maximum amount for the day from the ATM. He withdraws $280 off of Mary's debit account. This would be the last visual, physical, hard evidence we do have of his whereabouts. That is the only solid evidence. And you can see Mary's 4Runner in the background of the ATM camera. He never went back for more money. He did not drain the bank account. And I think that was because, alright, he was like, okay, so I'm just going to get as much as I can and get out of here and figure it out along the way. Now, of course, $280 doesn't get you far. Now, he's got a dog to feed, his mouth to feed. He's got a 4Runner, and I would imagine, if I didn't know what I know, that he'd have to find a place to stay. $280, let's eliminate the whole place to stay thing. So, just feeding his mouths, filling gas, and, you know, drinks, random stuff, you know, things he may need here and there. That $280 is gone fast, and he now has no job, no means of making money without the chance of getting caught. So he still to this day has never been seen pulling any more money out. No money has been reported missing from the bank accounts after that $280. So it's an odd situation. Where did he go? How did he go? How did he do it with essentially no money? So that left a lot of questions unanswered. So not long after, only 10 days after the murders, so that would make it April 20th now of 2001, Mary's 4Runner is found with a pile of human shit by the passenger door, and their family dog were found in Tonto National Forest, which is it's near Young and Payson, Arizona. Once they found that, the dog and the Forerunner, they're like, all right, where is this dude? Why do you leave the dog? Why do you leave a pile of his shit by the passenger door if he's just leaving the car here? And at this point, he's already, you know, a prime suspect. He became a prime suspect on the 14th of April. They didn't deem him a suspect for the first 4 days. They believed maybe he just went on a camping trip and didn't have a way to contact them or something. I had no idea what's going on, because he was known to just get in his car after a fight and go on a camping trip and just not come home. No contact for a few days, come home, act like it never happened. So that's what was assumed of him, which is why they didn't think much. Her family was all over the news saying, please come home, Robert. We love and miss you. We want to be here for you in this time. If you don't know what happened, please call us. So nobody at all is even at this, on the 10th now, is expecting him to be have part in this. And they thought it was just someone else or even an accident. Now, when he just never comes home, never contacts police, never calls the family and says, oh my God, what happened to my wife and my children? They're like, all right, something's fishy. I amuse myself. They realize, all right, something ain't right here. So back to when they found the Forerunner and the dog. They, of course, searched the area. There was many caves in the surrounding area. There was a nearby Indian reservation. It was Fort Apache. Now, U.S. police don't have jurisdiction in Native American Indian reservations. They govern themselves. They are their own entity. So U.S. police can't just walk up on their land and say, hey, we need to search the reservation. They would have to, you know, talk to the chief and whatnot to get that clearance. Now, is it possible that Robert had got onto the reservation one way or another? Yes. Is it likely? No. Unless he had known people on the reservation that were, like, very welcoming to him and knew him well, it was very unlikely that he found asylum at the reservation. Very, very, very unlikely. Which is why police, they never really followed any type of trail to the reservation. They never investigated anything about the reservation regarding him, being that the car was found right near it. Although they did search caves around the area. Now, they didn't search all the caves. I don't know why not. But they did search. They didn't find him. They didn't find anything leading to him other than the car. Although, after the reports were made about the car being found with the dog on the news, a couple came forward saying they had saw him walking along Young Road days prior and recognized him, although decided not to report the sighting of him until after the car was found. Because they were like, oh my God, that's Robert Fisher. Oh, what if it's not, though? And, I mean, a lot of people have that happen, you know. It's common that people will see a fugitive that has been plastered on the news, but not report it for the sole fact that they are afraid they are reporting an incorrect person. Like, oh, it's not him. He's probably gone way further by now. Why would he still be around here? Probably just someone that looks like him, blah, blah, blah. nobody ever reports these things. It's, according to police, it's actually less people make the reports than they do. So, police stop searching so vigorously after so long, because at this point they're assuming he had either died of a lack of oxygen from being in the caves too long, or he had committed suicide in the forest or caves due to, like, oh my god, I just killed my family and now I'm on the run, I might as well kill myself. But that also, is it possible? Yes. But is it likely? No. The reason it's not likely is statistically, if it's going to be a homicide-suicide situation, typically, and I say typically, the murderer will kill themselves in very close proximity to the person that they had murdered. It's usually a quick decision to kill themselves after the murder. And being that, to me, this seems very premeditated. Just for the fact that he had planned out to cut the lines, where to place the candle, who he was going to kill, and in what order. The only thing I feel like might have been spontaneous was that fuck you gunshot. Just because, like, I don't know. Why would he plan out shooting her an extra time? So, now that it's publicly known that her vehicle was found in the Tonto National Forest, now that it's known the location, an acquaintance of the Fisher family, Lori Greenbeck, she comes forward and tells officials that her husband had recently gone on a camping trip with Fisher to an area near where the vehicle was found, which this could be him scouting out the area. Like, okay, I'm gonna kill my family and I'm gonna be on the run. This is where I'm gonna run. Being that he had scouted it out, he might have found himself a hiding place that he knew, alright, nobody's gonna find me here. He might have actually left himself supplies there for all we know. Now, it's known that whatever type of gun that was used, I forget what caliber it was, but the gun that was used to shoot on Mary in the head was separate from any gun that was actively registered to Robert. And the gun that was used was not left in the home. The guns that were left in the home were in fact registered to him. Those were the guns that were known that he had. Now, being that it was a separate gun that's not registered to him, that tells me, okay, maybe he got this gun secondhand from someone, being that it's not registered to him, knowing he was gonna be leaving civilization for a while, living in the woods, need something to kill and hunt for food with. And I'm gonna assume, since he's not the most upstanding citizen, something to defend himself with, or kill anyone that tries to report him or comes in contact with him. So that also could be part of the premeditation, being that it's never said anyone reporting, like, oh yeah, I've seen him with that caliber of a gun on in any instance. Nothing about this gun that was used on Mary, being that it's not registered to him, there's not much information we have about where it came from, whose it was, how he got it, when he got it. We don't know any of that. We just know it's not his gun that he had legally, or I don't know if in that state, if it's legal to have an unregistered gun. I don't know. I don't know the laws there. But it's possible he got it and was like, all right, I'm not telling anyone I got this gun. That way, that's one less thing that can be tied to me. I'm going to use it for a fuck you shot. Or maybe he just assumed he was going to just shoot everybody. I don't know. We don't know what was inside this man's head prior to this day. We don't know what was in his head the day it happened, in the moments of. We don't know what's in his head now, if he is still alive. Now, it's very likely he could have survived all of these years under an alias. He could have lived in the woods off the grid, being that he was so outdoorsy and had been camping a lot in these woods. He might know his way around, may have, like I said, found asylum on the reservation, which again, very, very unlikely. We don't know where he is, though. We don't know if he's dead, if he committed suicide, died natural causes, lack of food. We don't know anything about him right now, about his whereabouts. It's possible that he could have died in the woods. Scavenger animals may have, you know, just ran off with pieces of his body and eaten him. We don't know. But the FBI has made it clear that they will continue to look for him and leave him as a top 10 until he either is found and convicted, or if he is confirmed dead, or if they have exhausted all options and all ways to find him. So, as of now, yes, he is in fact on the list as a top 10 fugitive for the FBI. Now, with that being said, and this whole story, it brings me to another homicidal story that bothers me a lot. This story, most households know this story at this point. It just came out on Netflix, the documentary. You probably already know what I'm talking about at this point. Chris Watts and Shanann Watts and Bella and Celeste. This story reminds me a lot of that family. You know, there's a lot of the same minor details. It was a husband who didn't want a divorce, who was... Now, we don't know if Robert was cheating on Mary, but we do know that Chris was cheating on Shanann, so there's that. But Chris was threatened with divorce. He didn't like that idea, so he goes and kills his whole family. Same deal here. He thought he was going to get away with it, but Chris did come back and act concerned and try playing the role of a concerned, worried husband and father. Robert did not do that. Now, like I said, this reminds me a lot of that whole situation. You know, two kids, wife, upset husband who puts on the face of being this great loving husband who actually is a piece of shit. Just recently, on November 2nd of this year, 2020, there was believed to be a sighting of Fisher in San Diego, California. He may be thinking, hey, it's been 19 years. I'm coming out into civilization. He was spotted, possibly, we don't know, and it has been dismissed by, you know, agents. They're not really entertaining so much this sighting. I'll explain that in a second. So he was believed to have been spotted at an upscale hotel in Omni,
It's called the Omni San Diego Hotel. And the reason that the FBI is skeptical is being that the driver's license name that was given at the hotel was Robert Fisher. Why would he be using his correct name? And how would he have gotten a ID with his correct name if he is currently on America's Most Wanted list? I don't know. It might be a fake ID that's just really good. But as of now, they're just putting it off as that it was just a lookalike. There was also a man in Canada who was recently arrested who, you know, fit the description, had the same missing tooth as Robert, which he had a gold cap on. He has a scar on his lower back from when he was in the Navy. The man in Canada also had the same scar. It really looked like him, had all of the points to be him, but it ended up not being him. They tested fingerprints and totally different fingerprints. And of course, people are going to say, well, could he have changed his fingerprints? No, he could not have changed his fingerprints. And if it was a burn-off type of situation, he would have total clean fingerprints. He would have no ridges. It would be flat surface. Now, if you've burned a portion of your skin, you would know what I'm talking about. That it's straight skin. There's no ridge. There's no, you know how you get the little swirlies in your fingertips? Yeah, you wouldn't have that. It would almost be as smooth as your fingernail. So they report there's no scarring in his fingertips that would reflect any type of tampering to his prints. So that is why that lead was shot down also. So being that all of these leads have been shot down, there's been hundreds and hundreds of calls made that, oh, I saw Robert Fisher at this place. Oh, no, I saw him at that place. There's been hundreds of them. And none of them have provided the hard evidence to FBI for them to entertain them. All of them have been proven incorrect. And as of today, he is still at large. He has not come forward. There has not been any physical evidence, video evidence, print evidence, nothing of where he has been, where he is at, or where he's going. So, as for now, we don't know if he's even alive, but if you are to see him and you think, oh my god, that's Robert Fisher, please call 602-279-551. That is the number that the FBI has released as a tip line for sightings of Robert Fisher. So if you do see him, or you believe you see him, please look him up. I'm going to post a picture of him on my Instagram. My handle is Most Wanted Podcast. That is one word, no underscores, nothing. Most Wanted Podcast. Go ahead, look me up, go find it. Again, if you see this man, do not approach him. He's obviously mentally insane. Probably to kill you. He probably won't, because you're not trying to divorce him. But for real, if you see him, call that number, 602-279-5511. Call it. If you see this man, go to my Instagram. I'm gonna post a picture of him. By the time this episode airs, I'm going to have his picture up with his description. And that's really it for this week, guys. Thank you for you listening, and I will talk to you next week.